Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
When you look at the details, it's abysmal. State salaries have fallen miserably behind.
A study on salaries shows many state employees are underpaid. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 14th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski encourages nonprofit leaders to continue voicing concerns about the Trump administration.
Keep calling, keep the emails, keep the social media going.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Senator Lisa Murkowski is urging Alaskans to speak out against changes the Trump administration is bringing to their lives and the government they've relied on.
Keep calling. Keep the emails. Keep the social media going.
Murkowski addressed a conference of 500 nonprofit leaders in Anchorage today, organized by the 4-Acre Group, which advocates for nonprofits across the state. Alaska nonprofits provide everything from water and electricity to human services. 4-Acre President Lori Wolf says some nonprofit executives are unsure whether they can commit to their plans and whether they can hire personnel, because even if they have funding now, they might lose it later. Wolf told the senator that some Alaskans don't feel safe speaking out.
What do you have to say to people who are afraid or who represent people who are afraid? We are all afraid. Okay?
Murkowski let that sink in for a full 6 seconds.
Quite a statement.
Murkowski is one of the most outspoken Republicans in Congress against many of the Trump administration's actions.
I'm oftentimes very anxious myself about using my voice because retaliation is real.
Among the programs and policies she's worried about, she cited Medicaid, possible deportation of refugees, energy and housing programs, and food assistance.
I'm operating off of rumors a lot of times, and then you see some things that are just unnerving in their scope, and you realize, well, that rumor was actually real.
Murkowski says Alaskans have come to her at airports and shed tears over losing their jobs or fears for their safety net. She says she's worried the chaos will cause her constituents to retreat. She asked Alaskans not to let anxiety and uncertainty grind them down. Well, Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration released a long-delayed study on state worker salaries last week. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
The study shows that roughly a quarter of the jobs surveyed pay less than the median market wage. The State Department of Administration declined an interview request for this story, but a spokesperson said via email that the survey highlighted areas where the state is competitive and several others where the state needs improvement. Nearly 3,000 state jobs were vacant at the beginning of this year, and public sector union head Heidi Dreigas says the fact that a quarter or more of the state's workers are underpaid offers some insight on that.
It's no wonder why they're having a difficult time attracting applicants to apply for these jobs, because they simply will make more money in the private sector or in public employment in other states.
Dreigas leads the Alaska State Employees Association, which represents a majority of the state's rank-and-file workers. A few job classes stand out as especially underpaid, according to the study. State biologists and physical scientists, along with wildland firefighters and economists, all earn far less than the market rate. Law enforcement officers tend to be above the market rate. State agencies have traditionally sought to align their pay with the 65th percentile, essentially paying their employees a little bit better than average. Compared to that benchmark, more than 40% of the surveyed jobs are paid less than the market rate. Dreigas says the state's decision to look at the median salary in addition to the 65th percentile obscures how much the state underpays its employees.
I think the state has done its level best to try to look at it through rose-colored glasses, but when you look at the details, it's abysmal. State salaries have fallen miserably behind.
The Department of Administration, meanwhile, says it asked for both figures in line with past practice. The spokesperson says state officials will review the findings of the study to determine whether salaries need to be adjusted, starting with those that are 10% or more below the market rate. Dragas, the union leader, says she hopes the study spurs the state to offer more competitive wages. She says the union plans to continue a lawsuit seeking to obtain earlier drafts of the study. The state says those were not used in decision-making and are thus not public records. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
An Anchorage judge declared a mistrial Friday morning in the case against a young man involved in a 2019 Unalaska car crash that killed two teenage girls. The decision comes after a group of jurors was unable to come to a unanimous decision. KUCB's Maggie Nelson reports that this is not the end for the nearly six-year-long homicide case.
Following more than 3 days of deliberation and over a week in trial, 24-year-old Dustin Ruckman was not convicted for his involvement in the deaths of two Unalaska teen girls, but he also hasn't been acquitted. The judge granted a mistrial after the jury returned a deadlocked verdict. One jury member, David, who didn't feel comfortable providing a surname, spoke with KUCB after the judge dismissed the group. He says it was an emotional experience.
And really hope that the community of Unalaska can come together and see it for what it is. It's just a really unfortunate situation that, in the grand scheme of things, I think it's just really unfair to apply blame to anybody.
In early May of 2019, when Ruckman was 18, he drove his truck up Unalaska's Mount Ballyhoo with his girlfriend at the time, 16-year-old Carly McDonald, and his friend, 18-year-old Kiara Renteria Haste. The truck eventually fell about 900 feet down the side of the mountain with the two girls inside. They were ejected and died in the fall. Ruckman sustained minor injuries, and he told police that he was thrown from the truck. He was facing two counts of criminally negligent homicide, but he went free Friday, for now. The jury began deliberations around 3 p.m. Monday, expressing concerns about a mistrial and deadlock almost from the start. The first note they gave the court raised concerns about a hung jury. That was written just about 2 hours from the start of their deliberations. Despite instructions from the judge to keep trying, the jurors returned a deadlocked verdict to the court Thursday afternoon. Matthews dismissed them for the day, and on Friday morning, he granted the mistrial.
At this point in time, given the time that you have taken, all of the work that you have put in, it's simply clear that you're not going to be able to come to a unanimous decision in this case. So I have declared a mistrial at this point in time.
The judge's decision was frustrating for many of the parties involved in this case, who've been waiting nearly 6 years for a verdict.
There's not a day that goes by that we don't think of her. You know, she, Kiara died one time, and every day she dies to me and Diana. And it's been a long process for 6 years going through this.
That's Derek Haste, Kiara's father. Kiara's parents have been attending hearings, trial calls, and meetings with lawyers since 2019. For the last few weeks, they've been in Anchorage attending the trial. In mid-March, they watched as the court tried to fill a jury in Unalaska. They couldn't find enough impartial local candidates and moved the trial to Anchorage. Still, Kiara's mother, Diana Renteria, says this isn't the end for their pursuit of justice.
That I failed my daughter trying to get accountability and justice, but, you know, a mistrial to me means that there's a possibility of maybe going back, trying again.
Renteria says the family may continue pursuing criminal charges against Ruckman. Ruckman's attorney, Julia Mowdy, declined a request for comment, as did Assistant District Attorney Patrick McKay Jr. Matthews scheduled a status hearing for May 13th to determine what comes next. Reporting for KUCB, with help from Sophia Stewart Rossi, I'm Maggie Nelson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a world-renowned composer writes an original piece of music for a middle school concert in Chugiak.
The next Taylor Swift is out there, right? The next Mozart is out there. These people are out there, and they're in our middle schools right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Fairbanks police say a Fort Wainwright soldier shot and killed another man Friday. 24-year-old Adeus Robertson faces charges of first-degree murder and evidence tampering in the death of 37-year-old Joseph Casas. Officers found Casas with a gunshot wound to the head Friday after someone reported shots fired at an apartment in the 1100 block of 27th Avenue, according to Fairbanks police. Medics took Casas to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. His next of kin have been notified. Police say Robertson was under release conditions related to prior criminal cases and had been wearing an ankle monitor. According to a statement, investigators used the ankle monitor's GPS tracking to place him at the scene of the shooting and locate him afterward, reportedly carrying a handgun magazine. Police say the investigators later found a gun in a dumpster near where the shooting had happened, and that witnesses from inside the apartment reported that Robertson and Casas were in the same room when they heard the gun go off. Robertson made an initial court appearance Sunday. His bail is set at $2.5 million. And Anchorage police are still seeking a suspect in a woman's fatal shooting Thursday at a homeless camp in Mountain View. Police spokesman Christopher Barraza says officers responded at about 8:30 p.m. Thursday to a city snow dump near Davis Park. They found 31-year-old Haley Ibarra shot inside a tent. Barraza says police questioned other occupants of the camp and are seeking an unidentified male suspect in the shooting. Police ask that anyone with information about Ibarra's shooting or surveillance video from the scene call them at 311. Federal investigators have issued a final report on the crash of a commercial cargo plane near Fairbanks last year that killed the pilot and co-pilot. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The National Transportation Safety Board report identified several maintenance and repair problems with the Douglas C-54 that crashed and exploded on April 23, 2024. The 8-page document says investigators concluded the two main causes of the crash were a loss of power in one of the aircraft's four engines soon after it took off from Fairbanks International Airport. But investigators were unable to determine why the engine lost power. The other main cause was an incorrectly installed fitting that caused a malfunction in the system that adjusts the propeller's settings. The report says a poorly repaired fuel leak on the number one engine also contributed to the crash. The engine exploded in flight, causing the pilot to lose control as he was maneuvering to return to the airport. The aircraft then careened off ice in the Tanana River and into a hillside about 7 miles southwest of Fairbanks International. The C-54 was built in 1945. It was operated by Wasilla-based Alaska Air Fuel, headed to the village of Kobuk to deliver 3,400 gallons of unleaded fuel and two 100-gallon propane tanks. It also had about 1,300 gallons of aviation fuel aboard to power the plane's engines. The report, issued April 1st, identified the pilot as 68-year-old John Slewinski of Anchorage and the co-pilot as 63-year-old Harry Sequoy of Palmer. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
As Kenai Peninsula School Board members grapple with a $17 million funding shortfall, the district has considered shuttering up to 9 schools to save money. Last month, some schools breathed a sigh of relief when the board whittled the list down to 3. But as KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, the angst is palpable in Nikolaevsk, where the community school is still at risk.
Bob Moore started teaching in Nikolaevsk in 1970. 6 years before the current K-12 school was built. He hauled the school's first chalkboards in through the woods from the main road and taught without books for his first few months. After arriving in the Russian Old Believer Village about 10 miles east of Anchor Point, Moore says he started knocking on doors to find students. More than half a century later, Moore joined roughly 50 people who packed into the school's small library Thursday night to plead with school district officials not to close the school.
And I'm telling you that our kids are worth it.
In recent years, the school's enrollment has plummeted. The school is built for 175 students, but next year the district forecasts only 19 will enroll. And as school district officials consider what to cut, Nikolaevsk School remains a top candidate.
I'm hoping that you can give them a chance to find the students and to encourage families to bring their kids here. I think it'll be in your best interest in the long run. Thank you.
It's been a rocky road for the school over the last few years. Community members tried and failed multiple times to open a charter school for students amid concerns about enrollment, school staff, and cultural needs. The district made some adjustments, but enrollment hasn't returned to pre-pandemic levels. But multiple people on Thursday said they feel good about the school's current trajectory under Principal Diane Maples, who started this year. Nikolaevsk parent Lisa James said having a principal who's willing to advocate for the school makes a big difference.
And she hasn't even had a year, and, you know, we're going to shut your doors. It's like, wait, wait, can we get a little bit more time just to see if we can, you know, before we shut it? Because like you guys said, it's 7 years. That's a long time.
State law says districts have to wait 7 years before reopening a school that was closed due to low enrollment. If the Nikolaevsk school closed, its students could be bused to Chapman School in Anchor Point, about 10 miles away, and to Homer High School, about 20 miles away. According to district data, Chapman is already more than 30 kids over capacity. Atticus James is a fifth grader at Nikolaevsk and is Lisa's son. His favorite subject is math, and he's trying to learn Russian to talk to his classmates in their first language. He's worried about changing schools. He's lived in Nikolaevsk his whole life.
It's close to my home. A lot of my friends go here. I would be pretty sad if I had to disband into other schools.
The district's budget woes are far from resolved. School board members built three budgets, each around a guess on how much money the state might chip in this year. The district also doesn't know how much money it's getting from the borough. All three scenarios assume full borough funding, but that's not a guarantee. Borough Mayor Peter Michicki has suggested he favors closing schools with low enrollment. On the education front, he says the borough can't afford to keep filling in the gap left by a lack of state funding. And since the borough owns school district buildings, its spending on facilities maintenance could change too.
We can try to be heroes in our local school, or we can work together on a survivable KVBST. That's all I'll say about that. We are going to have to consolidate half-empty schools into something that works.
The district estimates it would save just under $500,000 the first year after closing Nikolaevsk. But those savings decrease over time. Multiple attendees Thursday expressed interest in helping build the school's enrollment back up. One person suggested putting an advertisement in the Homer newspaper, while another proposed reviving Bob Moore's door knocking. Superintendent Clayton Holland said proven interest could help save the school.
You know, if you had a commitment and you trusted those people, I think that would speak loudly to the board. I can't say what the board's decision collectively would be on that.
School board members have until the end of the month to send a balanced budget to the borough assembly. Reporting in Nikolaevsk, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
It's a uniquely Alaska experience to see brown bears in the wild, but it's not often these encounters serve as the inspiration for a game. Katmai, the Bears of Brooks River, is a two-player card game where the state's most famous bears compete for dominance. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, game creators hope it will drive a passion for wildlife conservation.
Colorado's Peter Ridgway worked for the U.S. Forest Service in Alaska for several years. He recalls one of the job's most memorable moments, a day in the field near Huna in Southeast.
I remember watching brown bears fish for salmon in a river and was just, you know, taken by that whole experience. And I thought that would be absolutely a great topic for the game that I was trying to design.
Released in February, the card game features 24 real-life brown bears that call Katmai National Park home. Many of them have competed in Fat Bear Week, an annual bracket-style competition where chunky bears gearing up for hibernation compete for the most online votes. The game's objective is to establish dominance in different sections of Brooks River. Players can earn fish tokens for each section in their control. The player whose bears win the most fish tokens wins.
There's a lot of direct interaction between players. It can be a little cutthroat or have a little bit of a bite to it, but it's all in good fun as well.
Ridgway says he designed the game's first prototype at home during the pandemic. He took into account the unique characteristics of each bear and gave some of the cards special abilities based on the bear's personality. One of the game's featured bears is Diver. He's known for diving under the water to catch salmon. In the game, he's more dominant if you place him next to a deep pool of water.
That was probably one of my favorite ones to illustrate.
That's Tom Lopez, the game's artist. He says it was challenging to illustrate each bear in a way that reflects their personalities.
One of the primary goals with all the illustrations in the game was to convey a strong sense of motion. So there's a lot of variety in the different poses of the bears in each card.
Lopez, who lives in Australia, says he researched each bear online before illustrating them. The team also worked with the Katmai Conservancy, an environmental nonprofit, to learn more about the park's bears and how people can protect them. Ridgway hopes it will instill a message of environmental conservation in a fun way.
I certainly hope that when people play it, they fall in love with the bears and then they realize how unique and special these bears really are. And, you know, maybe along with Fat Bear Week, they'll begin to have a great appreciation for just the amazing environment and wildlife of Alaska.
Despite being set in Katmai, neither of the game's designers have been to the national park. But they say working on this game has sparked an interest in visiting. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
A mysterious sea creature lurks in the icy waters just beyond the Arctic ice shelf. That's the Inuit legend depicted in a song that Mirror Lake and Greening Middle School band students will premiere Tuesday night at 6:30. Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky went to band practice and has this story.
Eighth graders in Greening band director Philip Walters' class are rehearsing Kalupalik. It's a brand new song about a green-skinned sea creature who sings a siren song to lure children to the water's edge. Walter says it's one of the first opportunities for his students to work with professional musicians since the COVID-19 pandemic. He says he usually buys the pieces his students perform, but he started wondering if there was another option.
I wonder how much it would cost to commission a composer to write a piece of music. And so I looked into it a little bit, I asked around, and it didn't seem like it was out of the realm of possibility. So I just started contacting my favorite composers, and I got in touch with Brian, and he was like, yeah, I can do it.
Brian is Brian Balmages, a composer who's more used to debuting his pieces in large concert halls than the halls of a middle school. His compositions have been performed in Carnegie Hall and the Sydney Opera House, and he'll direct Kalupalik in the Chugach High School Auditorium. He's conducted in 46 of 50 states and will now cross Alaska off his list. He says he only gets to attend about half the premieres he writes, but he's looking forward to spending a full day preparing his music with the combined bands ahead of the concert.
My goal is to provide them the biggest amount of growth that I can. And my goal is when I leave there, I want them to want more. Right? I want them to want more music, more band, more opportunities to feel like that and to hopefully pursue those things.
About 100 students make up the combined band from Greening and Mirror Lake. This is a new experience for them. They've never debuted an original composition before. Walters is careful about rehearsing the piece with his students, leaving room for Balmages to make his mark in an upcoming rehearsal. Asked about the difference in writing for younger musicians, Balmages likens it to a visual artist illustrating, but with a smaller box of crayons. He says he's more nervous about the potential eruption of Mount Spur than he is about hearing eighth graders premiere his music to the world.
The next Taylor Swift is out there, right? The next Mozart is out there. These people are out there and they're in our middle schools right now. And the opportunity to go out there and work with them and potentially have an impact that changes their mindset and their way they interact with music is such a big part for me.
Hey. Mirror Lake flautist Kaya Christie plays a critical part as the flute section drives the eerie notes that make up the Kalupalik siren song. She started playing her instrument in sixth grade and says she's been looking forward to performing the piece since she heard about it last year.
It's kind of like I'm in shock because I would never expect something that I chose in sixth grade would take me this far to become an eighth grader and have an actual composer that many of us know come and compose us a piece and direct us through music.
Greening French horn player Tristan Matthews says the opportunity to premiere this piece of music has him excited about his potential future as a musician.
It's like a once-in-a-lifetime experience to be able to play a commissioned piece for the first time ever. It's really cool thinking that I'm going to be the first one to perform this.
When Balmages publishes the piece next year, Greening and Mirror Lake will be credited as the first bands to perform the piece when other school groups purchase the arrangement.
That's what the monster sounds like?
That's the monster.
In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Sophia Stewart Rossi, and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ashlyn O'Hara in Nikolaevsk, and Hunter Morrison in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.